We learn so much about history by learning a lot about the key figures, the political leaders, the inventors, the artists, and writers. Today we get a chance to learn even more about history by looking at the people standing next to the key figures, the spouses, the companions, the supporters, and the people who picked up behind the big names are featured in a handsome illustrated book called The Who, The What, and The When. 65 artists illustrate the secret sidekicks of history. 65 writers contributed as well, all organized by the authoring team of Jenny Volvovsky, Julia Rothman, and Matt Lamoth. All are partners in also a design company based in Chicago and New York. Welcome, Jenny.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
And welcome, Julia.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Good to have you both here. And Jenny, can you just tell us a bit about also and how it got started and what it is you do design work for?
Sure. Well, the three of us met in college at RISD. We all majored in different things. I studied graphic design. Julia did illustration. Matt did animation. And when we graduated, we thought it would make sense to combine forces and start a design studio. But we all obviously play a different role in it. So we've been doing it for about 10 years now. And we work for mostly small independent clients making websites and also designing books. And then in kind of spare time, we also like to work on these collaborative book projects like this one, The Who, The What, and The When.
And Julia, this is actually a successor to another shoe. You had the Where, The Why, and The How?
Yes, that was a book where we got scientists to write essays about unknown theories in science, things that weren't solved yet, and then we had artists give their own interpretation of solving that mystery of science. So it was the same kind of setup, but about a different topic.
This comes across as certainly fun to take a look at and flip through. None of the sections are particularly long. It's basically a two-page spread with a picture and text on each of the people involved. Do you have as much fun making it? I know it is a lot of work as well, Julia.
Yeah, it was really fun to make. Basically, we're organizing a bunch of writers that we thought were really interesting people and then artists who we admired for so long making artwork for the book. So, yeah, it was really exciting.
For either of you, really, we get the premise right off, but then the question is, really, Vladimir Nabokov chucked Lolita into the flames?
Yeah, we got to learn a lot of things working on this book ourselves. I mean, we didn't know any of these stories, so it was eye-opening for us to learn about all these people from history, you know, from writers to sports people to politicians. It's just, you know, artists we admired and then finding out who was behind them. So, yeah.
Well, you point out in the introduction that famous people gained dimension for you. How do you explain that?
Yeah, so I think that knowing a little bit more about the people and the famous people in the background, how they grew up, who their mothers were, you know, who their wives were, and how they played a role in forming their life, I think it kind of gave a bit of context to them as people and rounded them out and in some ways. You kind of understood what drove them and why they did the things that they did.
This is quite a stable of authors and illustrators. How did you collect them all?
Well, the writers were already people we found who were already working on something similar. So, like Joshua Wolfshank was writing a book about called The Powers of Two, which was about collaborative partners. So we approached him, and then, you know, somebody who already was a historian about a certain person, we approached them. Like, we have the granddaughter of a photographer who was Marilyn Monroe's photographer, took the famous shot of her with her skirt lifting up. So many of them are people who were historians that were already working on studies on these people. And then others were people who, you know, like the person who wrote about George Washington's dentist was a writer who, when he was really young, saw the dentures in a museum, and he's like, I have a really good story to tell. Can I do this story for the book?
Well, so. You mentioned the Marilyn Monroe picture because there's some fun stuff in here, certainly about iconic images and the people behind them. And, of course, we all know who Marilyn Monroe is. Everybody sees the picture of the skirt blowing up from the updraft from the subway vent. But I think the name Sam Shaw is unknown to a lot of people. That's a great story about how he moved this thing forward in time, and I kept the idea in his head.
Yeah, so I guess he had taken a similar photo early on in his career, and he wanted to recreate it with Marilyn Monroe, but he met her in this really interesting way before she was really a star, and she was actually his chauffeur to the sets. And then as she became more famous, because they had a relationship from before, they would work together, and he made this incredibly iconic photo of her that propelled her even more into greatness.
Which again is one of those interesting things about it. It's such a picture that is stuck in the American imagination. But these things happened because people who you've never heard of made decisions or did things anyway, and their momentum carried ahead.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Almost all of these, in all of these stories, you know, without this person, the sidekick, or the person behind the person, it's not really clear what would have happened to the famous person. You know, in some instances, they really made extremely crucial decisions or actions that changed the lives of the famous person and enabled them to be who they became.
And you know, actually, the first story in particular about the person who became Muhammad Ali, I mean, in a sense, the unsung hero of this story is not really a hero at all, but a person who actually stole Cassius Clay's bicycle.
Right. Well, actually, yeah, when Cassius Clay was 12 years old, he was going to a convention center, and his new bike, his red Schwinn, it was a Christmas present he was really excited about, got stolen. So he got directed downstairs to the basement of the auditorium, which also happened to be a boxing training center run by a police officer, Joe Martin. So Joe Martin, the police officer, takes down the information, but also Cassius Clay is going on about how he's going to get revenge on the guy who stole his bike. I'm going to beat him up, this and that. And so Martin says, well, do you even know how to fight? So he becomes his boxing coach after that, and that's how his whole career gets started.
The rest is literally history. We'll talk more to the creators, the co-creators of The Who, The What, and The When. Jenny Volvovsky and Julia Rothman, our guests, along with Matt Lamothe. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break. Back with Julia and Jenny and you in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening. We're talking today about some of the pivotal figures in history, but not necessarily them so much as the people standing next to them or behind them or just slightly out of picture range. Those are the people profiled in the book The Who, The What, and The When. 65 artists illustrate the secret sidekicks of history. 65 artists, 65 writers, all organized by the overall authors, Jenny Volvovsky, Julia Rothman, and Matt Lamothe. Jenny and Julia join us on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can too with questions or comments about some of the figures in history that we talk about. Phone number here, 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We already mentioned the dentures and how this story came in, but why is a dentist the sidekick listed for George Washington? I mean, how important was this person to George Washington's success?
Well, the author makes the case that George Washington, by the time that he became president, only had one remaining tooth, and he was extremely embarrassed by his condition, and the dentist kind of allowed him to kind of gain some confidence in himself. He lost his teeth when he was really young because he was a pretty sickly kid, and the way that they would treat diseases back then is that they would give you all this medicine that would rot out your teeth. And so the dentist came from kind of a family of dentists, but they met, I think, in New York, and they would communicate over mail when the Capitol moved. And because George Washington was so embarrassed by his condition, he would never mention dentures or dentistry in their communication. He would always avoid the subject. And the dentist was really inventive in the materials that he used to make the dentures. He didn't make them out of wood like everybody thinks he did. They were actually made out of gold and human teeth and tusks and other crazy materials. And, you know, you may think that they were kind of barbaric at the time. Now you think that the dentures were really barbaric, but at the time they were kind of the height of ingenuity. And when George Washington lost his last teeth, he gave it to his dentist, John Greenwood, and they were just really good friends, and that helped, and the dentist really helped him.
You know, I have to wonder if there are some disappointments along the way as you realize some of the things you thought through history are not true. I mean, did it disappoint anybody to find out, hey, George Washington's teeth really weren't made of wood or anything like that?
I don't know if that was a big disappointment. They are. I mean, if you Google these teeth on a Google image search on the internet, you can see what they look like. There's lots of pictures of them. They're actually in a museum. And they, I mean, they look like wood or something. I mean, they're like brown and yellow and just like look like the most disgusting teeth ever. So it's just, it's a funny thing to actually see them and realize that that was the best they could do at that time. And maybe people's teeth looked like that back then, so that's probably why they looked the best.
That could, the picture is pretty amazing. And again, this is a heavily illustrated book. I mean, each section, each person in history has a as an illustration too. The picture is actually looking out from the dentures at the face of John Greenwood, the dentist.
Yeah.
Talk about looking down in the mouth. Another great picture here is the one for Andy Warhol's mother, Julia Warhola. How did she encourage Andy?
So. Andy Warhol was also kind of a sickly kid, and he would stay home from school a lot. And his mother kind of encouraged him to do so because she was pretty lonely, and she was an immigrant from Czechoslovakia, and they didn't really know anybody in Pittsburgh. And when they would stay home together, she encouraged him to make art. That's how they would kind of pass the time. And they didn't have a TV or radio, so that's what they would do to entertain themselves. And because they didn't have too much money, she would give him comic books and grocery store labels to cut up and remake into something new. And that's really where he got all of his initial artistic ideas from, and kind of using popular culture to create pop art. And she would feed him Campbell's soup every day for lunch. And he really admired her as an artist as well, because she would make artwork at the same time. And he really loved her handwriting. And he would even have her sign his pieces for him. And they collaborated in a couple of books together, and she actually lived with him in New York when he moved there to become an illustrator. He was really, really struggling and destitute in the beginning, and she kind of helped him out a huge amount because he couldn't really survive on his own. And their relationship became more tenuous as he became more famous, because he started getting kind of embarrassed by her, and because she was...
Well, I live with my mom. Never sounds like a great thing when you're entering the jet set, yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah, when their relationship maybe didn't end so well. When she passed away, he didn't go to her funeral and couldn't really bring himself to tell any of his friends that she had passed away, but I think she was a huge influence in his life and really introduced him to art.
The excellent illustration here is by Leslie Herman, and it shows a woman with, you know, with white hair and a scarf on her head, pushing a shopping cart filled with Campbell's soup cans, which, of course, just gets you into the Andy Warhol story very quickly. We're talking to the authors of The Who, The What, and The When, 65 Artists Illustrate the Secret Sidekicks of History, Jenny Volvosky and Julia Rothman. There must be some mixed feelings in here about some of the characters you chose to profile. Queen Ka'ahumanu, who was Kamehameha I's wife in Hawaii. A strong woman, certainly, but, you know, her moves ended up in disaster for Hawaiians.
Yeah, yeah. She was the wife of the Hawaiian king who unified all the islands, and she helped abolish the kapu system, which actually forbade women to eat with men and at the same table and eat certain foods like coconut, banana, and pork. I don't know. So when her husband died, her adopted son became the ruler, and she kind of ruled with him. So they were rulers together. And so she made the first civil laws based on Ten Commandments, and she negotiated with the U.S. on the treaty, and she sort of embraced Christianity, which in the end led to the downfall of the kingdom. But she was a huge influence, so...
So it certainly deserves mention here, which brings to the question, I mean, how did you choose which people to include? I mean, you mentioned that some people came to you and said, hey, I'd like to do something about this guy or this guy. But I imagine, I mean, it's really hard to get down to 65 significant sidekicks through history.
Yeah, it was super, super hard. We tried to do research ourselves in the beginning, and we ended up finding some stories just through kind of trawling the internet looking for things like this. But once we approached the historians and the journalists and the authors, most of them had an idea in mind or a story that they wanted to do. So they really were the ones that came up with the ideas. And Julia mentioned Sam Shaw, Marilyn Monroe's photographer. That was his granddaughter who wrote that one. And a lot of people kind of had interests in the particular topics that they ended up writing about, and it was just a matter of condensing what they knew into a shorter passage.
So there's not a huge pile of rejects down the table from the ones you chose?
There are. There's a lot of Russian authors. We had too many Russian authors in there who had amazing wives, actually. Well, one of the more interesting stories is a recent story of a guy, John Maloof, who wrote his story from the first person because he actually discovered Vivian Mayer, this photographer, and her work. So we actually have somebody writing about his own life and how he discovered someone else. So it's a range of different kinds of stories. Some are people who just had a small contribution in their lives, and then some who were with them the entire way through.
I imagine this took a lot of discipline on the part of the writer, certainly, because, I mean, you probably want to know a whole lot about these people. And in some cases, there probably are lots of diaries, journals, letters, et cetera, left behind. But then you got to get it down to basically two columns on a single page.
Yeah, they had a word requirement from us. So there were some people who had very long essays, and we had, well, I'm sorry, you're going to have to shorten this. These are the things we think you can take out. And that was our part as editors, was sort of, you know, whittling it down to, like, what was the basics of the story.
And what was the word limit?
We can learn a little something about each person.
Mm-hmm. What was the word limit, just out of curiosity?
Jenny, do you remember what it was?
I don't. I think it was around 700 words.
Oh, really? Okay, that is not a great deal, yeah. All right, so one of the people we learned about here, we finally learned about Watson, as in, Mr. Watson, come here, I need you. And of course, there's a lot of dispute about whether Alexander Graham Bell ever actually said that. As we know, the phone company became the Bell System. Did Watson ever get much credit or much money for what he did behind Alexander Graham Bell?
I think he probably didn't get as much credit as Alexander Graham Bell, obviously, but he seemed one of these people behind the people who kind of liked being in the background. There's a couple of those in the book where it seemed like they didn't want to be in the forefront, and I think Thomas Watson was one of them. He was an engineer at heart, and he really liked to make things, and so he made all the parts of the initial phone as an assistant when he was 16, and he kind of propelled the phone into popularity. But then when Bell's company got big and his role became more managerial, he was really bored with it. And so he quit and went on to do a whole slew of other things. He farmed, he traveled, he learned a lot of different languages. He like opened up a huge shipyard. So he really wanted to be the maker, and those people typically end up being behind the scenes. So he probably didn't get as much credit as he deserved, but in some way that was probably not by accident.
We're talking to the authors of The Who, The What, and The When, or two of the three anyway. Jenny Volvovsky, Julia Rothman, and Matt LaMoth put the book together. They are the design firm also based in Chicago. The Who, The What, and The When is about 65 artists illustrating the secret sidekicks of history. And you can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange about famous people and famous people standing next to or behind them or just out of the picture. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, good morning. First of all, I have it on good authority that the labor dispute between Santa and the reindeer has been resolved, and they are on their way.
Good to know.
And ladies, I'm missing one of the most important people behind a great person. What about Mrs. Claus?
Ah, decided to stick to the historical here, I guess. Thanks for that, Paul.
Absolutely. There has to be some, seriously, on the serious note, the underlying serious subtext to this is there has to be some kind of a historical referent to go along with Santa, because there's all kinds of different historical reference that goes with St. Nicholas.
All right.
So I'll take my answer off the air.
Great. Thanks for that, Paul. Appreciate it. Well, St. Nicholas, did he even come up as a potential subject for the book?
He didn't come up, but that's a good idea.
Yeah, we didn't consider fictional characters, but, or, you know, or I guess.
Well, maybe it's not fictional.
All right. I'm glad you said fiction, because I was ready to say, sorry, kids. I said fictional.
Don't ruin Christmas.
Right. I have to wonder how much digging some of these took on the parts of the individual writers. Again, each of the essays is written by a different person with an illustration by a great illustrator. For example, finding out about Alan Turing's first love.
Yeah, actually, I think that author was a big researcher of his and had written some essays or a book about him. So he was looking at the letters of Turing. But if people don't know who that is, he was the first love, or so the author says, the boyhood crush of Turing. And I guess Turing was a bit awkward. He was young, and this kid, Christopher Morcom, was really cool and smart, and together they would talk about math and science. But then Chris died suddenly from bovine tuberculosis, and that death devastates Turing. So the author is saying that Turing was inspired to go on to try to figure out how a brilliant mind like Christopher's could be separate from his physical brain, and that all his studies are associated with that. And so his initial boyhood crush was all inspired by that death happening.
Wow. And I have to wonder, though, but which raises the question about a process again of the book, because Alan Turing is much discussed right now, particularly with the Benedict Cumberbatch movie, The Imitation Game, in theaters. Would this have been a different book 5 or say 10 years ago?
That's a good question. What do you mean? Because I think it probably would have been a similar book, because the stories are still as interesting now as they would have been 5 years ago or 5 years in the future.
They are as interesting, certainly.
But new people would have been discovered, are you saying?
Well, yeah, in a sense that people come up into discussion, you know, and then they'll kind of lay fallow for a few years, and then maybe they'll come up in discussion again. And Alan Turing, because of The Imitation Game and some other recent works, is certainly a person who gets discussed a lot now.
Yeah, well, actually, when we did this book, though, that movie wasn't, we didn't even know that movie was coming out or anything related to it. It was so funny because we'd be working on this book, and we were putting all these stories together, and then, like, in the news, Amelia Earhart was in the news because might have found a piece from her airplane in the water, and we were like, whoa, that just happened, and maybe that's great for our book, or, you know, the Alan Turing, or, you know, so. And there are a lot of new, you know, there's that new movie, Big Eyes, that's coming out, that's about an artist who didn't get represented, a woman behind a man. And maybe if we had known about that story, that could have been included in the book.
Which brings up the question then, I mean, how often we do tend to focus on the people just out of range of the picture? Because, you know, in history classes in elementary school, you know, we're taught that, you know, who the heroes are, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Nathan Hale and John Paul Jones, et cetera, Thomas Edison, but none of it, you don't know the names of any of his assistants, for example.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's easier in history to kind of focus on one person, tell the story through the eyes of this one kind of alone genius. So I think that, you know, for people who are more interested in history, they delve deeper a bit and learn kind of all the surroundings around this famous person. And that's when they discover, you know, the assistants and the wives and the people along the way who were really influential.
Our guests are Jenny Volvovsky and Julia Rothman. They are the creators with Matt LaMoth of The Who, The What, and The When, 65 Artists Illustrate the Secret Sidekicks of History. Jacob Notown given sends an email. He says, it seems every great leader or innovator had some sidekick or co-leader. Would you ask your guests if, in their opinion, there is any great man or woman who was entirely self-made with no sidekick? Well, they probably wouldn't have made it into the book, but what did you guys find out like that?
There is no person who is self-made. I think that's a myth, that there's like a lone genius. I think everybody has had somebody who has influenced them. I mean, when you think about your own life, would you have become what you are if you hadn't had certain people influencing you? So I just think it's impossible to not have been inspired or helped in some way by somebody who's contributed to your life.
So back to the characters in here, Alma Revel, who's Alfred Hitchcock's wife, how influential was she on he and his work?
Well, they were married for over 50 years, and she was a film editor and actually more established than him when they first started working together. But she wrote some scripts, she played tiny roles in his movies, she just helped all around. Most notably, she was the one who found the era in the film when the woman was swallowing when she was supposed to be dead in Psycho. And she was also the one who convinced him to add the music in the background to Psycho. So without that, it might not have been as dramatic.
I mean, the famous music?
Exactly. Imagine that scene did not have that music. I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't have been as strong. But, they had one child, but their sort of physical life might have been slim. He was thought to have affairs and things like that, but I think that they had a really strong relationship. And in his Lifetime Achievement Award speech, he said, I want to thank four people in my life. I want to thank my film editor, my scriptwriter, the mother of my child, and the best cook. And those are all Alma, my wife.
Wow.
So
that's wonderful. We learned so much from this book, too, because for one thing, we learned that there was, in fact, a Tupper behind Tupperware, Earl Tupper. But then another step removed is Brownie Wise. What did Brownie do to make Tupperware so big?
So Brownie Wise was a saleswoman who kind of started off just selling Tupperware on her own, and she came up with this new sales tactic for Tupperware parties. And that would employ women who were typically, you know, stay-at-home wives. And I think it's kind of unclear how they met, but she ended up, you know, calling Tupperware the company and working for him. And when she was employed, he kind of gave her free rein to be a salesperson, and she created all these crazy theme parks and sale conferences where she would bury prizes in a field and made a wishing well where you put your dreams inside Tupperware. So she was really, really inventive in how to sell the Tupperware.
Huh, great. And the Tupperware party and everything else that went along with that. Much more to talk about with Jenny and Julia, Jenny Volvovsky and Julia Rothman, about the who, the what, and the when. 65 of History's Sidekicks, back on the Jefferson Exchange with them and you, if you'd like to join us in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guests today are the creators, the overall creators, or two of the three anyway, of an interesting book about people who stood next to or behind some of the major figures in history. The book is called The Who, The What, and The When. 65 artists illustrate the secret sidekicks of history. Jenny Volvovsky, Julia Rothman, and Matt Lamoth, the creators through their design company, also based in Chicago and New York. And we have Jenny and Julia with us, and you can join us on the Exchange as we talk about some of the interesting people in history, just one off from the people who are better known than them, perhaps. 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area, 800-838-3760, email jx@jeffnet.org. Woodrow Wilson got married in the White House, and how significant did that act become through the person we learn about in the book?
Well, Wilson had a stroke, and it wasn't his first stroke, but it was really bad, and it left his whole left side paralyzed, and he was kind of incapacitated. So at that time, Edith, his wife, steps up as sort of the sole conduit to the president, and she only lets herself and the doctor and the personal secretary see him face to face. So basically, she is deciding what the president gets to see and not see. So everything passed through her for 17 months. I mean, that's a really long time. So for 17 months, she was kind of like this fake president. So she kind of kept his condition somewhat secret, and she just really wanted him to remain president, so she did what she could do. Some people just nickname her the first woman president.
But the amount of control she had was astounding, and you wonder if anything like that would have been possible today. Did you find out if the media of the time were even aware of what was going on? Of course, there was no broadcast media then.
Yeah, it seems like she really did a good job of keeping it secret, because he was able to communicate through her, and the country kind of ran as almost normal. It seemed like everybody was fooled that, you know, he was really in control.
We talked earlier about how you point out in the introduction to the book that finding out about some of the other people through history gives you a greater, they add dimension to the famous people, the people we do know. And you very much get that with Ward Kimball, who was an employee of Walt Disney. What was Ward all about, and what did we learn about Walt Disney through him?
Well, Ward was an animator for Disney, so he was the guy who created Jiminy Cricket and the Mad Hatter and the Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland. He was the guy wearing the crazy patterns and the polka dots and making everybody laugh in the office. And he was a big fan of railroads. He loved them, and so much so that he made his own in his backyard, like a giant one that he could actually sit on and ride on his lawn. So Disney was his friend, and he was one of the best animators. And one time Disney came over to his house, and he's like, oh, well, let me try to ride on that railroad. And he liked it so much that I think that it inspired him to make his own ideas and plans for Disneyville, which later would have become Disneyland, because of Ward Kimball's first train. So eventually, when Disneyland got created, Ward was like the chief advisor on developing everything train-related for the park.
There's a situation sometimes in the workplace. I don't know if you guys have experienced this too, but where you get a boss who's kind of grumpy, and then another employee comes in who's got a sense of humor and keeps the boss lighter and actually makes for a better workplace all around. And I wonder if Ward Kimball was that guy for Disney.
Seems like it. Also, another person, if you Google and look at pictures of him, he's got a huge smile. He's doing something goofy. He's wearing polka dots or stripes or some kind of crazy color. He just looked like an all-around fun guy to be around.
They always had big round glasses, too, which are well represented in the illustration. I read about Ward Kimball a few years ago through Trains magazine, actually, where he's represented there, too. We have another call for you. Let's go to Grumpy John at Grants Pass. Looks like the Santa Claus thing won't die. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, Grumpy John.
Well, thanks, and happy solstice to you all.
Happy solstice to you.
I called because Paul was concerned about Mrs. Santa Claus.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Santa Claus was based on St. Nicholas of Myra, and he was a 4th century Greek Christian bishop. So there probably wasn't a Mrs. Claus.
Good point, Grumpy John. Thanks for bringing that up. Oops, I took him off too soon. Go ahead, Grumpy John.
Thank you.
Sure, take care. All right, we'll just leave that there. I never thought much about the mentors of criminals, and you guys include one of those in the, a couple of them actually in the book. Who was the guy who was considered a mentor to John Dillinger?
So John Dillinger's mentor, I think they met in jail because I think Dillinger was arrested for kind of a petty crime, and he actually learned to become, you know, a mastermind bank robber while in jail. During that encounter.
Wow.
So I think a lot of these criminals kind of learn more about crime when they get arrested for something small.
Makes you stop and think about the correction system when people learn to be more effective criminals from the people they meet behind bars.
Right.
And in this case, it was Harry Pierpont for John Dillinger. Some stories in here, particularly for Elvis Presley, for example, and for Jerry Siegel, the co-creator of Superman, it's the absence of someone that seems to have a great impact on them, and profoundly so for Jerry Siegel and his father, Michael Siegel.
Yeah, so Michael Siegel was Jerry Siegel, who was actually the creator of Superman's father, and Michael... When Jerry was a little kid, Michael owned a secondhand suit shop, and Jerry is just a kid with 3 siblings, and he's kind of quiet, and he reads comic books all day and hangs out, but he wants his son to be part of his life. Anyway, one day a man comes into the store that Michael is running and steals a suit, and Michael is so upset and in fear that he has a heart attack, and he dies. And so Jerry, the author of this article, is saying that Jerry created Superman as an alter ego to his father, someone who can fight back and, you know, become the man that he wanted his father to be when that guy stole the suit.
How much myth-busting went on in the process of creating the Who, the What, and the When? I mean, I wonder if you had some of the writers go into this project thinking they knew things about some of these sidekicks and came away thinking, oh, wait, that wasn't quite what we thought it was.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't have too many preconceived notions about these people. For us, most of these stories were kind of the first time we were learning about them, so we didn't have too much myth-busting, happen for us, but... I'm not sure about the authors. I think that, you know, maybe the wood indentures for us was a bit of a surprise.
For the George Washington's dentures were not, in fact, wood, as it turns out. And the other story that I mentioned in companion with Jerry Siegel's father, Michael, Gladys Love Presley, Elvis Presley's mother, it seems like some of her habits and proclivities were a bit of a foreshadowing of her son's end.
Yeah, so Elvis was born a twin, but his twin was stillborn, and his mother... thought that Elvis was really special in the one because of the circumstance of his birth, and she always told him she was, you know, he was really, really special. They were incredibly close and slept in the same bed, and she introduced him to music. She gave him his first guitar at the age of 11, and the first 2 songs that he wrote were actually for his mother. I think one is called My Happiness and That's All Right Mama. They were both for her and about her. And then when he left home because his musical career took off, she was extremely worried and concerned about that something that would happen to him. And so in the process, she got really depressed and started drinking and popping pills and putting on weight. And like you said, it was kind of a foreshadowing of Elvis's own death. And so she died of a heart attack in the late 50s. And after her death, his music never regained its intensity. And he kind of did a really similar thing in the 30s. He gained weight and took pills and overdosed on meds in the late 70s.
Sad story. A lot of these stories are very sad.
Sad for the sidekick, or sad for the person they stood by?
For everybody all around. Oh. Like, it's always, I mean, when you're doing a book about sidekicks and people who never got the credit they deserved, you're bound to have like a kind of a sad sort of theme running through it, because people aren't getting the credit they deserve, but also just a lot of people were influenced because something traumatic happened. So
true, and certainly these two most recent examples, and of course the one I'm looking at right now is about G.P. Putnam, who was Amelia Earhart's husband, and I don't know if that many people are even aware of you know, people who heard of Amelia Earhart and they've heard of G.P. Putnam's sons. He was the publisher, right?
Right. So yeah, when Amelia Earhart met him, she was kind of like an anti-marriage, independent woman, and Putnam was a publisher, an author, and an adventurer, and he commissioned flights, and he was looking for sort of the right girl to be the first woman to cross the Atlantic by plane. So he offered her no money, but said he would make her famous. So he was her publicist, and then he promoted her, and he proposed to her for marriage 6 times before she said yes. At age 39, she's going to go and take this around-the-world flight, which Putnam arranged, but that's when she disappears over the Pacific. So,
she apparently wanted a fairly loosely structured marriage.
Yeah, she actually asked him if they could have an open marriage because she didn't want to be tied down.
Yeah, and I think she said that if it doesn't work in a year, she wants out. I think that was part of the marriage arrangement.
Hmm. And of course, he ended up on the end of the tragedy there too when she disappeared. So let's move on to something a little happier. Eleanor Callahan. Yeah. Here's another the story of another photographer, Harry Callahan. His wife was his model, and it sounds like she was spring-loaded and ready to jump into action whenever he needed a model.
Yeah, so if you look at his pictures, almost all of them, hundreds of them, are her posing for him in all kinds of situations, many times nude. And she was happy to just drop whatever she was doing to devote her life to his artistic talent. So she supported the family as like the secretary, and she taught and made art, but mostly her job was to support her husband in his artwork.
You mentioned that that you could have had a whole book full of Russian writers, or at least a lot of them anyway. So I do want to get to Fyodor Dostoevsky and his wife, Anna Dostoevskaya, and her pivotal role in his success as a writer. What was it that she did that goosed him along?
So she basically saved him from poverty. They met when she was 19 years old, and she came to work for Dostoevsky as a stenographer, and he was already a famous writer. And in the beginning, she didn't really like him and couldn't really imagine a romantic relationship. But, you know, through writing The Gambler together, they fell in love. But her main kind of claim to fame, and the reason why she was so important to Dostoevsky, is he was a gambler, and they had huge money problems. And he wouldn't have been able to go on writing if she hadn't taken over the family finances. And she decided to self-publish his books and analyze the book market, negotiated with book distributors, and really just started publishing his books and to get him out of debt. And once she did that, she was able to free up, you know, more time for her husband to write. And that's how he was able to continue working.
Particularly with the women in the book, there are a lot of situations where it seems like what they did for other people are things that they could have been doing, and not necessarily in this particular case, but you know, the things that were denied to them as women, as second-class citizens in their time, things they may have created or done for themselves rather than to do through somebody else.
Yeah, it's too bad, actually. Nowadays, we hope that if we were to do a more modern-day version, that it would be a lot of men behind women, and that would be nice.
Let us take another call. Here is Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jeannie Volkovsky and Julia Rothman. Yeah, go ahead.
Zelda Fitzgerald, Beyond F. Scott. I read where she was an alcoholic, but they thought she was nuts. Maybe she did become nuts, but they put her in a sane asylum. It was made of wood, and it burned down, and she died. They said she wrote some of his stuff. Not that he wasn't great, but Zelda Fitzgerald, what about that?
All right, thanks, Gene. Was she somebody who was considered for this, or did she cross your radar?
She didn't come up, but it does sound like the kind of like Vera and Vladimir Nabokov, because many people think she had a lot. Was possibly a part writer of his work, and she had such a big influence on it.
There is a dog in the book. There's a dog who gets his own spread. His name is Carlo. He apparently died in, looks like, 1866. Who was Carlo?
Oh, he was actually the puppy who was given to Emily Dickinson. Oh, and she was just 19. And they don't know too many details about him exactly, but he is kind of a big dog. And since Emily was such a recluse, it was Carlo who got her to get out of the house and go for walks through the woods. And he lived for over 16 years. And they say that Emily Dickinson wrote her best poetry while her dog was her companion her whole life.
Wow.
And after she died, she wrote, "I explore little since my mute confederate died."
I was just reading that. That's a really, really gentle sort of way to remember the dog. And it's just so much to this book. It's really hard to describe it on the radio. But it's called The Who, The What, and The When. 65 artists illustrate the secret sidekicks of history. Jenny Volvovsky and Julia Rothman, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
You bet. Take care and happy holidays to you.